the work week, am I right? But do you know what would make it a little bit better? Doing church on a Sunday and then listening to a podcast about the sermon. Welcome to the Post-Sunday Blues, a preaching postmortem, a production of Liberty Church Collingswood. Each week we'll spend some time unpacking Sunday's sermonics, and we hope that you'll be able to connect a little deeper with the message and the messenger. It's a win if we can make your work week a little less blue. House lights down, everybody. We are coming at you with some seven deadly sins on this seasonably cool March day. And I am with the preacher at Liberty Collingswood from this past Sunday, Clint Jenkin. Are you keeping warm?
Yes, I did have to walk to the train station today, and I wore my scarf for the first time in a couple of weeks.
Oh, are you a headgear wearer when it comes to cold weather as well?
Yes, I didn't used to be, but my natural headgear is leaving me, so I have to compensate.
Fair enough.
I have very large ears that get quite cold, and they catch the wind, and I'll actually get headaches from it.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. If we have time at the end, we'll do a deep dive on diagnosis there. But in the meantime, Clint, let's talk about the sermon that you preached this past Sunday on envy in the Seven Deadly Sins sermon series that we've been doing in the season of Lent here at Liberty Church Collingswood. It was a really great sermon. Really appreciated it. Made me envious to get back in the pulpit. Just kidding. But let's sort of go through the standard script for talking through a sermon, calling it Stormy Monday. I'll ask it this way. Why'd you ask to do this sermon?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, and then number two, what was God doing in you over the couple of weeks of preparation before going into the pulpit?
Yeah, I thought that of the seven sins, if I was going to pick one, obviously it would be envy because that's the one I picked. But the reason for that is you don't hear about it a lot. You do. I mean, it comes up, but we wouldn't really call it one of the major sins. Like pride or lust or greed or things that we kind of think of immediately. It really is that it develops from a social context. I'm always fascinated, both professionally and personally, by how we interact with each other as humans and how that interaction, goes good or goes badly and kind of routes us in one direction or another. And so envy being a social sin that emerges from a social context is really what caught my attention. I thought it'd be a fascinating one. I think this can maybe come up in some of the other questions, but envy is such a surefire way to sabotage your own happiness. And we deal with it so extensively in our modern context that really pulls at my heart. I struggle to see people be so miserable with so much plenty and so much goodness around them. And the misery just keeps going up and up and up, no matter what else is happening. And I truly think our addiction to comparing ourselves to others, I use the word addiction very loosely, but our addiction as a society to making these comparisons with other people is just, it just hurts me what it's doing to people.
100%. You used the phrase during the sermon that I wrote down. I liked it so much, I wrote it down in my notes. We live in the golden age of envy.
Oh, absolutely.
We do. And to put the same idea another way, we inhabit an envy-driven economy where envy is monetized. And I guess we are skipping ahead a little bit here, but envy is monetized and people make money off of the fact that we're consistently envious of other people.
And a lot of our political discourse, the bad part of our political discourse is driven by leaders and, that's being too generous. people good at communicating who have a message of envy. Of look what everybody else is getting that you're not getting. Look how everybody else is doing and compare it to how you're doing. and I'll tell you all the ways that I can help you get a bigger piece of that pie. It just, you know, so even though we think of it as kind of this, we don't think of it as often as we think about other sins. I believe it drives so much of what we don't like about our society.
Totally. And then to ask the second part of this question before we go more specifically into your sermon text and what you were finding in various directions, if you've known, and you're not alone in being someone that struggles with envy, but if you've known that about yourself, was there anything specific going on over the past month as you've been gearing up for the sermon as far as self-reflection and envy one way or another?
I don't know if it's specific over that recent of a time period. It's definitely, you know, in my life, I've been very upwardly mobile from how I grew up and where my family came from to where I am now. And I noticed a few years ago that I was becoming less satisfied, even as I was becoming more upwardly mobile. And that bothered me. And I see it with my boys as well, of just the difficulty, how difficult it is to be happy with what you have. And it's not related to how much you have. It just isn't. There's no connection. There's no correlation between how much you have and how happy you are with it. If anything, it's a negative correlation.
Yeah.
But it's certainly, so to try to prepare three boys for a life where they're not constantly frustrated with their station in the world, whatever that ends up being, I don't even know. I feel like I was fortunate in that I recognized it early in myself, that this is not a path I want to go down. So I'd say it's been a past few years that it's been kind of a big part of how I try to think about myself and the world.
Yeah. And it was evident, Clint, that, right, one things that I tell younger preachers that I give a little bit of coaching advice to, I forget if you've heard me use this phrase. As a preacher, you want your coffee beans to be slow roasted as opposed to, you know, microwave. So you want to be a deeper, more reflective roast in what you talk about. And I felt that from the sermon when you were coming from a place of deep Christian reflection and life experience and talking about envy. So it was clear that this wasn't the first time that you ever thought about something like this or were.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I don't see it as something I have spent time on it, but it's with a sermon like this, I have the benefit that you don't get, Jim, of like, I preach, you know, three times a year, if that. And so, and I know, you know, several months in advance what it's going to be. And so a lot of times I'll spend more time. I actually spent more time on sermon preparation when I first kind of got this topic, like I'm going to study this. And I really front load for this time. I try to do it every time, but this time it worked. I really front loaded my sermon preparation. And so I felt, so that gave me the time to think. You know, I had a couple of weeks to really think about what I had learned and what I had read. And then the week leading up to it, I actually did very little other than just kind of organize. It didn't help that I had switched notebooks during that time, and I had left my notebook with all my notes in it at work.
Oh, no.
That is very far away for those who are listening who don't know that. It's not just, oh, I'll swing by work and get my notebook. Like it's a couple hour round trip. So I just kind of had to refresh them from memory and find them, you know, go back to some of the websites I had seen and that. So that helped. I think having that a lot of runway helped me with that.
But that's the self-help empire that you have yet to build, but you will very soon. Forget your notes and start over every time.
That's right. I don't recommend it. It kept
well, it
things.
Worked.
I'm sure it was shorter because of that.
It was great. Sun Studios, BB King, James Version. The Before you talked about it in the passage, I gravitated towards a specific phrase in your sermon text from end of 1 Samuel 17 and 1 Samuel 18. Tell me why do you choose this text for envy, and what jumped out to you about it?
The text actually came last, which is also different from how I normally approach these things. And it feels weird of like, oh, I'm going to have all these things to say, and then I'm going to like find a Bible passage that, you know, seems to fit. And it's not how I recommend doing it.
Yeah.
But I had gone through kind of a list of Bible characters who were envious. Mm-hmm. And none of them really felt like what I wanted to capture about envy, because a lot of what I wanted to capture about envy was not about having things. A lot of time, and it is combining envy and greed. They're very similar, but I want to try to, so I land on that one because it wasn't a one that you'd normally think of. I mean, people do think of Paul, of Saul as an envious of David, but not in that passage with Goliath. It's often kind of a separate thing. And so I like the idea of taking a passage that is all about victory and all about miracles and all about God's providing for his people. And then when you look at it again, it's like, no, this is actually the root of Saul's envy for David. And it's like this whole undercurrent that's happening while we're thinking about how amazing everything is. And that's just so similar to what we have in our lives. Like everything's going right and it just doesn't matter because there's something about somebody else that we would rather be or have.
Right. So I thought this is a brilliant sermon text for envy. And this is David slaying Goliath and then Saul being jealous of how everybody's celebrating David afterwards. Saul
even
is
though
down.
They're still celebrating him. It wasn't even a celebration for David. It was a joint, like he was also being, it was just amazing. It's just so spot on.
Yeah. So when you had emailed some combination of me and Rebecca, our administrative assistant, with the sermon text, and my first thought was, what's Jenkin doing here? I saw it 1 Samuel 17, David and Goliath.
Yeah.
And before actually looking at the verses, I thought to myself, how is David and Goliath? Yeah. How does that connect with envy at all? And my first thought was, is it that people envied Goliath's strength, or
but it
seemed pretty tangential. But then when I looked at the actual passage, especially including the Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s, it was clear as day to me when, wow, this is an envy passage par excellence.
We have to skip into the next chapter to see that because there's a parenthetical story, but then it goes back. And so when you actually read it, the song about David and Saul happens right after Goliath, but it's several verses and even into the next chapter before you see it. And so so you don't really realize the timing that they kind of skip around in timing.
Right.
But when you see the time, when you actually think, oh, wait a minute, like, let's put this in sequential order, then it becomes like, okay, that's when Saul started eyeing David was immediately after Goliath.
Yes, Clint, this is the power of preaching. I don't think I'll ever be able to look at these two chapters again without thinking about your sermon. So you've imprinted on the rancor with this one here.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad.
And what grabbed my attention was from that last verse, and you hit on it in the sermon, after Saul is envious that David's getting more accolades than he is, and Saul eyed David from that day on.
Yeah, it's great.
Tell me more.
So that was a coincidence, but if I was like, that's what envy is so often described as. now part of what's also going on, I'm oversimplifying Saul's concern. It wasn't just that he wanted David's accolades. He was concerned about his son Jonathan not being the next king, which turned out to be a justifiable concern. So there was a tangible issue that Saul was having, and so the eyeing was also more on a practical level of like, let's keep an eye on this guy.
Yeah,
but I like the visualness of that. You can just kind of see the stare down, right?
Right.
That Saul would give David and who was so completely beneath his station that it's like, why are you even looking at this guy at all, let alone kind of grumbling about him?
Yeah.
So, and then it just fits so nicely with how envy is often portrayed in some of the other references that I gave, but in literature and in poem, of envy being the green-eyed monster, or envy is always seems to be associated with the eyes, because it has to be. It stems from us, you know, looking around. It's like we can't keep our eyes in our head, you know, similar to lust in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a cinematic detail. I think of one of the gospel accounts with Peter's denial. I think it's the gospel. It's only the gospel of Luke that includes a detail that after Peter denies Jesus three times on the night that Jesus was captured before his crucifixion, as the cock crows, Luke recounts that, and it's hard to imagine how this, I mean, we believe it because it's in the Bible, hard to figure out the geography of the situation, but Luke records after Peter denied Jesus three times, the rooster crowed and Jesus looked at Peter. And there is something striking about the eye contact. And so similarly, this is a verse made for cinema, and Saul eyed David from that day on. Yeah. So this passage captures envy in a few different dimensions, and then you talk through characteristics, conditions, and the cure for envy. Let's talk more as we go into muddying the waters. Let's talk a little bit more about the golden age of envy economy, maybe as it more specifically relates to the conditions that you were talking about of living in a world that makes it easy for us to envy.
Yeah. It's funny. There was a part of me that wanted to just preach this entire sermon about Instagram and just let's just lay into social media, and let's lay into Instagram and Twitter, and really Instagram, I feel like, is the kind of the poster child for this. And even in my sermon prep, I just knew I'd have to restrain myself a little bit.
Sure.
Because for one thing, I don't want to do the Holy Spirit's work for him. It's like, it's not just social media that drive people to envy. But also it's a little bit more impactful if you don't say it. It's like, it's, you know, let people give that last 10%. And so I decided I don't want to go into social media. I don't think I even said it. I was trying not to even say the word social media.
You did not say it. I noted it was good. Conspicuous, and it was constructively conspicuous in its absence.
That's what I was going for. But I could have done an hour just on all the damage that those types of things do to our understanding of what's normal and how we fit into what's normal, because it warps both of those things so badly. Yeah. So the conditions, but there's also something uniquely American about envy, in that we're a land of opportunity.
Yeah.
And the idea that you have opportunity is actually good for envy and bad for us in that way. I mean, it's good in other ways for us. I'm not saying we should go back, but it's fascinating. When you go back in literature and read, you know, actually, I made the joke about Kevin and I watching, Kevin and I really did watch War and Peace. We're in a book club reading War and Peace.
Love it.
And, Tolstoy in his books adores the peasant farmer.
Yeah.
And you see it in some British literature as well, this idea that the peasants, especially when you go back to this like feudal or late, you know, feudal aristocratic driven societies, the peasants are portrayed as morally pure. And one of the reasons they're portrayed as morally pure is because they don't envy. They don't have this desire for things that they don't have. They kind of understand what their place is in the world, and they accept it. And to the aristocratic authors of that time, they saw that as a beautiful thing. I think we might see it a little differently. But, you know, Tolstoy was an aristocrat. And so were a lot of the British authors that write. And you know, so you have this sense of anything's possible, which can add fuel to the envy fire, because then we see things and we're like, why couldn't it be me? Like it could have been me. It just,
right.
There's very little between me and that other person. And then what's happened, that's just the American experiment. And there's a lot of value that comes with it too. But what's happened more recently is then the sense of, but now look, now we have this warped view of what other people are actually experiencing. So we only see the best of what they want us to see. We only see the most beautiful people. We only see the most beautiful people's most beautiful moments that they were able to capture it with the most beautiful technology. And then that's presented to us like it's just, oh, this was a Tuesday at 9 o'clock and here's what I'm doing, you know, sipping my latte in my, you know, $1 billion condo. So, so this whole mixture of you can be anything you want to be, and these people are living your dream, and it's not even real, but it's just how they're able to portray their lifestyle. You know, you couldn't fashion a world that would lead to more envy than the one we live in. I mean, I'm sure you could, but I don't know how it's possible. Yeah. I don't know how it's possible to out envy or create a better growing environment for envy.
Yeah.
Which makes me, you know, interested on a, but also kind of sad. So like it's tough. How do you shape people to understand their real place in the world? And to really see their blessings for what they actually are, when just every last speck of input they're getting from around them is to be unhappy, is to want something more. So it's discouraging, but fascinating in the same time.
It really is. And one might say that the pendulum has swung. So if feudal Europe many, many years ago had its own set of downsides, if you were living in that period, but positively, there was probably less envy. So you mentioned in your sermon, specific conditions for envy. You need to be around lots of other people. You need to see into lots of other people's lives. You need the ability to heavily edit what's presented about your life, and then a large vision for what's possible for you. Those are all hyper modern conditions, and not before that. There's a whole new set of downsides now. And the interesting thing for me, and this relates to God's past, God's present, and God's future, if the pendulum has swung from you're stuck with whatever you're stuck with and you have no agency or ability to change anything about you or your situation at all, we hope you like it because you're born into it. If now the pendulum has swung to you can change anything and everything about yourself and your position, intriguingly to me, historically speaking, arguably, we never passed through a stable middle ground there.
Sure.
And we await a new heavens and new earth when we'll be freed of envy in ways that we've never been able to attain apart from Jesus' transformation of us. The best makeover that we can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
The resurrection of the body and life everlasting. What God ultimately gives us in some ways is what we're envying towards in our hobbled ways at this point.
Yeah, it's a good point that the relationship with God is the great nullifier of envy, because if our sense of ourselves is driven from how we relate to God and not how we compare to other people, then it kind of takes the air out of the balloon for envy.
Right.
So I would imagine when God is visible to us, that'll be even easier.
Yeah. And going back historically one more time, there are plenty of positive historical examples of people that believing in Jesus advocating and enacting great change in our world. So it was not a quietism or a passivity that the gospel called people to. And at the same time, whatever we're able to do on our own is always going to be incomplete, and it's never going to solve the problem of the human heart. And I think it's, you're right to say that we're in a uniquely difficult spot. And if Envy is uniquely American and has been for decades. Now all of those things have accelerated all the more. So we're in the hyper phase of wherever we've been.
Well, and it's so much of it is driven by our comparison set. I have a notebook where I just kind of keep quotes and things that I find. One of them, I don't know where it came from because I'm not great about sourcing this stuff, is your happiness is highly determined by who you compare yourself to. Because the truth is we have a choice of who we want to compare ourselves to. But we have to make that choice. It's not a natural. Naturally, we don't compare ourselves to the less fortunate. We just don't. It's not a nat. I don't know why. There's probably, you know, something to understand there that I don't understand. But we just don't naturally make a comparison between ourselves and those who are doing worse than us, not on a long-term basis.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a good thing. Maybe it's part of the human condition that we want to better ourselves. And so that's the yardstick we use. Maybe we'd be too slothful if all we did was compare ourselves to those less fortunate.
Yeah.
But it takes a real act of will and a repetitive one to say, who's out there that I feel that will help me feel good about myself, not to their detriment.
Yeah.
But, you know, I use the example of running. It's like, you know, it's, you're never going to win by comparing yourself to people who can run farther or faster or more often than you. There's a lot of people who would love to go up the stairs. And it's like, if I can keep that, it's like, I enjoy running because I can, and I could be in a world where stairs present a serious physical difficulty to me. Now I feel much better about my ability to run, and it hopefully doesn't take away from people who struggle to go upstairs. But it's just that sense of like, we can make the choice to who we want to compare ourselves to.
Yeah.
We never, it doesn't come naturally to kind of look at people who have less than we do. We have to push ourselves there.
Right. And when we do, that's pride. So that
that's true. Yeah. There's that, the other pitfall. That, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, pride and envy
next week.
maybe two sets of the same coin. Josh Postlewaite coming up.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit more about the cure for envy before going to some bar band cover tunes. I love the references that you gave this past Sunday. Let me point out what on the surface was something that may have sounded contradictory in your sermon. And I mean that tongue in cheek.
It might have actually been contradictory.
It made all the sense in the world. I doubt that this is just me asking you to talk about something more. So you observed in the middle of the sermon that one of the conditions for envy is you need to be surrounded and see into the lives of a lot of other people. Absolutely true. And then also as part of the cure for envy, you mentioned community.
Yeah.
Other people. So on one hand, other people are are part of the problem when it comes to envy, but then you also talked about them as the cure. And just to be clear, you were clear in the sermon, but I'd love to hear you talk more about how do we receive the blessing of other people in ways that reduce our envy versus other people just let other people feed our envy all the time.
I think there's a practical aspect and there's a philosophical. The practical aspect is when good things happen to other people, there's very often a downstream effect on you. That's a positive thing. So just being able to notice what those are. And I mentioned like, my neighbors have a nicer house than me. I can walk through my neighborhood and I don't have to look at a bunch of my houses. I can look at nicer houses.
Yeah, that was great.
You know, but then there's the philosophical viewpoint of it's empathy. It's like, can I see their perspective? Can I enjoy something on their behalf? And I think the way I talked about doing that is understanding that we're all part of the same group. So much of what we envy is because we see a disconnect between us and the person we're envying. Like we see a connection, has to be enough of a connection for us to feel like, oh yeah, we're like that person. But there also has to be a disconnect because we can't envy somebody we truly want the best for. And again, it's very difficult to envy your children, right? Like my children have gobs of things I never had.
Yeah.
And I'm just delighted, you know? And so we can't truly envy somebody we also truly love. And so I think it's that ability to draw that connection closer, so that we really have empathy for the people and we really see ourselves as kind of united. And that's the difference between a community and a crowd, is the crowd is just, oh, we're all here looking at each other. And the community is like, we have a common, you know, something, common purpose, common effort, whatever it is. And blessings would go into that common bucket.
Love it. The 20th century British missiologist and missionary Leslie Newbegin talked, and I think the phrase originated with him, that the church is called to be a countercultural community in the world. And I think this is one of the ways that the church can do that, where we are engaged with the lives of other people, but in ways that are not envious and jealous of one another, but we're truly celebrating the good of others, which is a cross-shaped impulse. And we see that you talked at the end about trusting in what Jesus has done for us. If Philippians 2, Jesus considered others more highly than himself. If our chief example is the one that went lower for other people, who are we to take the high road? And even try this on. I'm thinking about this in real time. So maybe this is a horrible idea, but I had mentioned earlier that envy and pride are two sides of the same coin. But you could also argue that envy is a form of pride.
Yeah, it's definitely a sense of I'm owed something, or I wish I was owed something. But it's kind of the same thing. Like there's this idea of I've been wronged. I've been wronged because somebody else is doing really well.
Yeah.
And I think so. And I think you have to have a certain amount of pride to get to the I've been wronged part.
Right.
Because you have to have this sense that somebody has an obligation to you in order for you to be wronged.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier current political climate and otherwise. I think you would agree that injustice is real and those things should be addressed, but then fostering a culture of grievance is not the same thing. And if one can masquerade as the other, but if we're just constantly reminding people of how aggrieved they should be, that's not a recipe for internal or community wholeness.
There has to be some sort of ability to have restoration. And right now, all the incentives on the part of political leaders on both sides is to delay or prohibit restoration. And this, I don't want to get into politics at all, but this is the first, this is the first time where I look at what's going on and saying, I'm not sure that I can be a part of it at all. I may actually have to sit this one out. I may have to be a conscientious objector to democracy. That's not a decision I've made, but it's a feeling I have of like, I don't know if there's a way I can be true to how God wants me to be a citizen and actually be an active citizen. I might. Jim, I understand there's so many people who would have all kinds of disagreements with me about that. And I may even disagree with myself about it, but I have a tension there I've not felt before of, I don't know if I can even participate in this type of how we're approaching each other and talking about our political discourse. I'm not even sure I can participate in good conscience.
Yeah. I don't think that's controversial, at least in what you're saying, Clint, about feeling a growing distaste and displeasure about the entire discourse and mechanisms of public comportment. And
we're getting away from envy, but it's what you're saying about grievance. Of like, there's a difference between acknowledging injustice and working to overcome injustice, and fomenting frustration and irritation and disgust with the people that we live with. That's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah. But not completely unrelated to this idea of envy. Good stuff. Bartman cover tunes. You referenced a lot of different people and folks, and I thought it was really good. Yeah. So who do I have? We have Spenser, Shakespeare, Dante, Aesop or Aesop.
Yeah. Yeah.
You asked me in real time if I knew how to pronounce it. I assumed that you didn't want me to stand up and directly address the room on that question.
The flow, I think you handled it you optimized the flow. it's the same as Caesar, right? It's got to be Aesop because it's the same lettering as Caesar, but I don't know if I'm saying Caesar right.
Yeah. Well, like it's a whole Greek thing. So sometimes that AE in English, you have that single character for the A and E together. So yeah, it's just a big problem. And the bottom line is that nobody really knows how it was pronounced all those years ago anyway. So,
well, there we go.
Yeah.
So we'll say Aesop.
There we go.
So it matches Caesar.
did you have these references in a Envy file somewhere, or was this just looking around the internet? Or some combination?
I've been fascinated. So my wife is very, very philosophical.
Yeah.
She reads a lot of philosophy, modern and ancient. And she's had me listen to podcasts and various things about the Middle Ages, the medieval man. C.S. Lewis, this got her into it. He was fascinated by the whole framework that the medieval man person.
Yeah.
Would use to understand their world and how the modern person has gone so heavily into science that they've lost a lot of their ability to actually understand the world.
Yeah.
Because they're constantly trying to explain it.
Right.
So I've just been on a kick lately about looking at medieval thought and literature. Some of it directly from conversations I've had with her. I've never read Edmund Spenser's Faerie Queen. When I looked up medieval envy in medieval literature, it came up and some excerpts came up. I have read some Dante, not a lot. I shouldn't say I've read a lot of Dante, not all of it, thankfully. But and what was the other one? Shakespeare. And Shakespeare I've read a little bit of, not as much as I should. But they all come up when you search, how does envy treated in the medieval time period? And so they are great. They're great references to that. And the fact that they all talk about eyes was fascinating to me.
Right.
That is there really is this connection between envy and eyes. And I think in Dante also there was a weight. I'd have to go back and look, but they had their eyes shown shut. And I think they had to carry extra weight to bring them low. I think that was part of it as well. You had to see yourself below how you normally would. And so I think there was a humility idea as well that Dante worked in there.
Love it. And this isn't a cover tune, but I appreciated how you observe. And I hadn't thought about this either way, that of the seven deadly sins, envy is the only one that's universally reviled, where other traditions around the world will take some of these other seven deadly sins and say, actually, this is a good thing, but nobody's on team envy.
Not that I've seen. I don't know. It could be out there somewhere, but I've not seen it. And I don't think I realized that when I started, but just kind of looking through and it was like, man, everybody hates this. There's nobody's willing to put in a good word for envy. and that's fascinating because it's hard to find a sin like that. Most sins, somebody somewhere is willing to say you should do it.
Yeah. Envy is picked last for the kickball team. On the seven deadly sins. Well, Clint, this is kind of where we wrap up with Guitar Slim Pickings. Are your feet at a stable size right now, or are they still growing uncontrollably? So
they grew another half size when I started swimming.
Okay.
Which was 5 years later. So at age 35, I started running. My feet grew a full size. At age 40, I started swimming and they grew another half size. And I am now at the point where I cannot buy shoes at a regular store. I'm in size 14 most of the time.
Wow.
And most stores have a very limited selection of size 14 shoes. 13 is usually where, that's what they keep in stock. So, it's funny, Jim, I grew up with the smallest feet in my family. All the men in my family had 13, size 13, or my brother had size 15, my twin brother. And I always wanted bigger feet. I always wanted size that you want to be 6 feet tall. You want to have size 13 feet. And yeah. I'm 5'11" and I have size 12 feet. So I got one of those wishes that my feet are now 14, which is a little bigger than I wanted. I'm still 5'11", unfortunately. Only going to go down from here.
But the feet are magnificent. Where do you shop online for shoes at this point?
Yeah, what's you do find size 14 sometimes, but I mostly have to. I now mostly wear Brooks shoes, and so I just buy them online now that I know I like them.
Okay. Well, keep us posted. Yeah. Maybe we check back
clearance
in.
Racks. The good thing about it is when you do find them, you can often find them at a very good price. So I do check the clearance racks whenever I go into a store, because you never know.
Good tips. Love it.
Yeah.
Anything else to wrap up? Any parting
shots? I have
thoughts?
One more thing. Because I this is the one thing I wish I could have gotten into that I didn't. There's a lot of tips and tricks for not being envious. And a couple of them are like, well, you find the flaws in what you want to envy, right? So it's like, oh, I love that big house, but man, I never want to pay the taxes on it. Or those people are probably in a lot of debt. And so there's this way of dealing with envy that is sort of picking at the people you'd be envious of until you're no longer envious of them. Mm-hmm. And it's not a good thing to do. I would say we want to resist that temptation of finding flaws in the things we're envying or the people we're envying for two reasons. First of all, it's not very charitable.
Yeah.
But it doesn't actually deal with the envy. All it does is it takes that thing that you're envying and you're just convincing yourself that that thing is not worth envying, but it doesn't actually deal with, you're just going to find something else that is worth envying.
Yeah.
And so that was the kind of the one thing that I didn't know how to work it in, and I was getting a little on the long side anyway. But that was my caution, is like, it's so easy to be like, oh, I'll just find faults in whatever it is that I'm envying, and the envy goes away. It's like, it doesn't go away. It gets transferred to something that doesn't have those faults.
Yep.
And you're not actually dealing with the envy at all. You are literally just pushing it onto something else. And you're not acknowledging that it's a sin, that what you're doing is a sin. You're just saying that, oh, I'm not envying efficiently enough. Like I'm not being selective enough in what I envy, rather than like, I shouldn't be having this attitude at all. So that's one thing that if there's anything else I wish I could have gotten into a little bit more. It's like, there are other ways of dealing with envy that actually just compound it and make it almost more sinful, because now you're mixing in bitterness I don't know. You know, you're being hard on your fellow man, and really the way out of envy is to be more charitable towards your fellow man, not less.
Right. Yeah, that's really good, Clint. In the material, among the materials that Josh Postlewaite sent us related to the seven deadly sins from John Cassian and Avargius and those people, I think that one of the images used there from Cassian is one of uprooting, and there are sin patterns here that God invites, calls, commands us to uproot. And I think whether it's seven deadly sins or otherwise, it's easier to practice sin management than sin removal.
Yep.
And
that's a good point.
And one is not the other. So, well, that's one of the reasons why we have the podcast, to be able to, to add those extra little bits.
But you know, I was right on time. I told you after my last sermon that went 45 minutes that I was determined to not let that happen again. So I kept this one just under 30 minutes. And you just can't say everything.
It was awesome. It was svelte.
Thank you. It's probably the shortest I've ever gone when I actually had something to say. So I'm pretty pleased with myself, to tell you the truth. I don't know if I'll be able to hit that bar every time.
It was awesome. Including the length. No notes.
Right.
Well, Clint, this has been wonderful. If you have any questions, I guess next week is going to be me interviewing Josh. Okay. But Helen Wolves, if you have any thoughts so far about some of these other seven deadly sins or something for Josh on pride, which is the culmination.
So, This is the other thing I didn't get to. I didn't regret this one as much, but I told you this before, Jim. I want to get it on the record that Gilligan's Island can be interpreted as a morality play about the seven deadly sins, where each of the characters represents one of the sins. Envy would be Marianne, which is also the weakest link, because Marianne was generally, not causing trouble on the island. But she would represent envy. Pride would be the professor. Mm-hmm. But the idea is they stayed on the island because every time something happened, one of them would sabotage, one of them, as the deadly sin, would sabotage their ability to get off the island. So want to get that out there. Maybe Josh can use it.
I'm glad you brought that up. I had forgotten to mention that in any of the previous podcasts, but Howling Wolves, go do your homework. Consider, think, go on Mr. Googly, Gilligan's Island, Seven Deadly Sins. See what you find. And write in to postsundayblues@gmail.com. Clint, thank you so much.
Sure thing, Jim.
How was it?
That was amazing. Thanks so much for joining us. This has been the Post Sunday Blues, a preaching postmortem, a production of Liberty Collingswood. Go ahead, rate, review, and subscribe, and you can find all things Liberty Collingswood at libertycollingswood.org. No more Post Sunday Blues. Here comes some pre-Sunday happy.